Jesus died on the cross to give us back the choice that had been taken from us. The choice of where we will go after this life. Romans 5, verses 12 to 19 says, "When Adam sinned, sin entered the world. Every sin brought death, so death spread to everyone, for everyone sinned. Yes, people sinned even before the law was given, but it was not counted as sin, because there was not yet any law to break. Still, everyone died, from the time of Adam to the time of Moses, even those who did not disobey an explicit commandment of God, as Adam did. Now, Adam is a symbol, a representation of Christ, who is yet to come. But there's a great difference between Adam's sin and God's gracious gift. For the sin of this one man, Adam, brought death to many. But even the greater is God's wonderful grace and his gift of forgiveness to many through this other man, Jesus Christ. And the result of God's gracious gift is very different from the result of that one man's sin. For Adam's sin led to condemnation, but God's free gift leads to our being made right with God, even though we are guilty of many sins. For the sin of this one man, Adam, caused death to rule over many. But even greater is God's wonderful grace and his gift of righteousness. For all who receive it will live in triumph over sin and death through this one man, Jesus Christ. Yes, Adam's one sin brings condemnation for everyone, but Christ's one act of righteousness brings a right relationship with God and new life for everyone. Because one person disobeyed God, many became sinners. But because one other person obeyed God, many will be made righteous. We were created as autonomous beings, beings that could make choices and decisions. We can do whatever we want. We've been given that ability, obviously, physical limitations taken into account. But even there, we wanted to conquer the sky, we conquered the sky. We wanted to conquer the sea, we conquered the sea. We wanted to conquer space, well, we're working on that one still. For much of my life, I thought that when I died, that I was going to get into a long line of people, all waiting our turn to stand before this judge who was waiting for us, and this person would tell us whether we had earned the right to step into heaven or whether we didn't. But I think Scripture has something different to say. John 3:16 says, "For God so loved the world that he sent his only Son, so that whoever believes in him will not perish, but have eternal life." And I struggled very much with this verse for much of my life while I was trying to sort this out. Is it because of how good I am, or is it because of God's gift? I remember a story that I read a long time ago that I think highlights this very well. Many here will know the name C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis is one of the great Christian thinkers. He's no longer alive, but he's written a ton of books and papers and all sorts of stuff, and his ideas are revolutionary even today, but he wasn't always that way. C.S. Lewis was born a Christian, and when he was young, he walked away from the faith. He was a strong atheist. Through his college years and early adulthood, he would argue against the existence of a higher power, against any existence of God. But when he was about 32 years old, through his life experience and through many conversations with Christian friends, such as J.R.R. Tolkien, he came back to faith. And when he came back, he didn't go halfway, because that's not the way C.S. Lewis did things. He dove in because he wanted to sort through the messiness. He wanted to figure out this thing called life and what our relationship is between us and God. He also wrote a series of children's books called The Narnia Tales. They're a series of 7 books, and they're fantastic stories. I grew up on them. And in these books, there are children from our world who from time to time get pulled into this land of Narnia, which is a country of talking animals and mythical beasts. And these children get pulled over into this world to help the Narnians in various situations, various issues that they're having. Aslan was a lion, and he was the creator of this world that Narnia was a part of. He is the representation, he is C.S. Lewis's representation of God in these stories. and in the last book of this series, called The Last Battle, the children once again get pulled into the land of Narnia. But this time, as indicated by the title of the story, it's the final battle. And this time, Narnia doesn't win. A neighboring nation called the Calormans finally defeat them. They've been trying to take them over through many of the stories. This is a hundreds, thousands of years long feud between the two countries. But the story doesn't end in conquest of Narnia. It ends with the sun and the moon dying and this massive door opening to a new, bigger, brighter, more beautiful Narnia. And Aslan walks through the door and stands beside him. And then Father Time, who's a giant, wakes up and stands up on the horizon and blows his horn. And when he blows his horn, all the stars, which in Narnia are living beings, fall from the sky and fly through the door into the new Narnia. And then we see thousands, millions of creatures running from the distance up to the door. And it's all the creatures and people that were living in this entire world at that point. And they're running up to the door. And as these creatures approach the door, as these creatures and people approach the door, they each make eye contact with Aslan as they come close. And one of two things happens. Either they take on a look of fear and hatred, and they run off into the darkness, or they take on a look of joy and excitement, and they run past Aslan through the door into the new Narnia. The narrator makes a comment that even one of the creatures that ran through was a dwarf who in the final battle had turned on the Narnians and had killed some of the talking horses. He was one of the ones that took on a look of joy and excitement and ran through the door. These beings had a choice. The moment they made eye contact with Aslan, could they accept a higher power? Could they accept a god? Could they accept this god? And if they could, if they made the choice, despite everything that they had done, they were allowed entrance into this version of heaven, because this was C.S. Lewis's version of heaven. We see some of his beliefs coming through in this fictional story. I'm not arguing that everything C.S. Lewis says is dead right. We're humans, we're fallible. But I find it interesting, and I think it's great to look at differing views from what we believe, because it helps us figure out what we believe. It helps us figure out what God's saying to us through the Bible and through his stories and through his theologians. I believe that we as humans, the same as the creatures in Narnia, have a choice to make about whether we can accept God as our God or whether we can't. And that's what it comes down to is, and it doesn't matter where you are in your life, doesn't matter where you started or where you finished, can you accept God as your God? And is that fair? No, it's not. It's not fair. There are people that suffer their entire lives for their faith. And there are people that come to faith at the very end, like the dwarf. The dwarf who had done terrible things right up until the last moments. But then he realized what he had done. He realized, to use the quote, the error of his ways. In Matthew 20, there's a story of a field owner. And in the morning, this field owner, he needs his field harvested. So he goes out to the city gates and he finds some men who are looking for work. And they agree to come and harvest his field for the day for, I believe it's one piece of silver. I should have checked this. I didn't. I believe it's one piece of silver. And then later in the morning, he goes out and he finds some more men at the city gate who are looking for work. And they agree to the same amount, one piece of silver, to harvest for the entire day. Early afternoon, the field owner goes back, finds some more men. They agree to work for one piece of silver, harvesting for the rest of the day. And close to the end of the day, the field owner goes back again and finds more men looking for work, and they agree to work for one piece of silver. And at the end of the day, when everyone comes to gather their pay, obviously the men that have been working since the morning are upset. Rightfully so. They're getting one piece of silver, which is the exact same as these men who had just shown up and barely done anything. But the field owner makes a very valid point. He didn't cheat anyone. They had agreed to this. They had agreed to come work for one piece of silver. Or the story of the thief on the cross. Luke 23, verses 39 to 43. One of the criminals who hung there hurled insults at him. "Aren't you the Messiah? save yourself and us. But the other criminal rebuked him. Don't you fear God, he said, since you are under the same sentence? We are punished justly, for we are getting what our deeds deserve. But this man has done nothing wrong. Then he said, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. Jesus answered him, truly I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise. The thief on the cross was one of the men who was hired at the very end of the day. He had no time to do good, and he hadn't done good. To be one of these people on the cross, this man had done some terrible things. Because Jesus was unjustly on the cross, but he admits that he earned it, which means he wasn't just a thief. We call them the thieves, but they weren't just thieves. They will have likely done a lot more if we look at historical accounts at the time and what you had to do to earn crucifixion. And I believe for much of my life that it was how good I was at following God's rules that would determine whether or not I got into heaven. But that can't be the whole story. Because otherwise, this thief never would have been granted access. Because he didn't do the right things. He didn't. Until the very end. When he chose Jesus while he was on the cross. In the very beginning, God created mankind. Well, he created everything. He created the world. He created the oceans, the trees, the birds, everything. And then he created man. And the first, fun fact, did you know that man wasn't created in the first 7 days? I didn't know that until I was actually studying for this message. It wasn't like God created man and it was good. He created everything and then he just created man over here. It's very interesting. Sorry, please side note. God created man and the first thing he had Adam do was name all of the creatures. All of them. In the entire world. Every creature he had created. So, Adam does this. We don't know how long it takes, but I can't imagine that this was a fast process. So Adam spends however many eons naming all these creatures just to find that none of them are a perfect companion for him. It says this right after. Theologians believe that this was one of the reasons that God had Adam name all the creatures so that he could discover for himself, so that humankind could discover for themselves that none of the creatures that God created were perfect. God wanted to involve us in all these things that were happening. So Adam wanted a companion. So God created the perfect partner, an exquisite creature of beauty and sarcasm. Woman. My Oma was a wonderful, wonderful woman. And I just remember one time I was at their house having breakfast at the breakfast table, and my Oma comes in and she goes, Mr. Jono, do you know why God created women second? I wasn't sure where Oma was going with this. So I said, no. She goes, because he didn't get it right the first time. And then walks away chuckling to herself. So God fixed his mistake when he made men the inferior beings by making women our perfect companions. Not dogs, women. And it was good. We had the choice. God let us get to every single other creature he had created just to discover that we needed women. And as many of you know, there came a day when Adam and Eve chose wrong. They chose to eat the fruit from the tree, which they weren't supposed to do. They chose to blaze their own trail, to set their own course. They wanted to know what they hadn't known up to that point. And this is where many people start wondering, why was it that God gave us free will in the first place? Why did he create humans with the ability to decide? Because if Adam and Eve hadn't had the choice of the tree of life, the tree of good and evil, not the tree of life, had in the choice of the tree of good and evil, sin would have never entered the world. We wouldn't have had the travesties that happened all over, the horrible things that people have done because we have choice. Why did God give us free will? Once again, I'll bow to C.S. Lewis from his book Mere Christianity. God created things which had free will. That means creatures which can go wrong or right. Some people think they can imagine a creature which was free but had no possibility of going wrong. But I can't. If a thing is free to be good, it's also free to be bad. And free will is what has made evil possible. Why then did God give them free will? Because free will though it makes evil possible, is also the only thing that makes possible any love or goodness or joy worth having. A world of automata, of creatures that work like machines, would hardly be worth creating. The happiness which God designs for his higher creatures is the happiness of being freely, voluntarily united to him and to each other in an ecstasy of love and delight compared with which the most rapturous love between man and woman on this earth is mere milk and water. And for that, they've got to be free. Of course, God knew what would happen if they used their freedom for the wrong way. Apparently, he thought it worth the risk. If God thinks this state of war in the universe a price worth paying for free will, that is, for making a real world in which creatures can do real good or harm, and something of real importance can happen, instead of a toy world which only moves when he pulls the strings, then we may take it. It is worth paying. When Adam and Eve chose to trust the serpent and were sent away from the Garden of Eden, we lost our ability to get into heaven. When they were sent away and the gates of the garden closed, so too did the gates to heaven, because there was no way to get back. We didn't have a playbook. We didn't have an instruction manual for how to get there. We had created a divide between us and God, and we didn't know how to get across it. Many years later, God called a man named Abraham to choose to leave his family and go on an adventure that he didn't know how it was going to end. And frankly, he never even came close to seeing the end. But he chose to obey. So him and his wife went and followed God, and his descendants became the new nation of heaven. They became the Israelites. But even they had no way of getting there. Romans 5, verse 14, which is part of our original text today. Nevertheless, death reigned from the time of Adam to the time of Moses, even over those who did not sin by breaking a command, as did Adam, who is a pattern of the one to come. Once the Israelites, who were Abraham's descendants, had gone to Egypt and been slaves for a few hundred years, and then escaped through the Red Sea, led by Moses, they were given the Ten Commandments, plus a slew of other rules. 613 rules to follow, all with their own punishments or sacrifices that they would have to give as a result of whatever sin they had. So we had kind of a playbook for how to be good followers of God. For the first time since Adam and Eve left the garden, we had something to follow. But the problem was we couldn't do it. We couldn't keep all these rules. We tried our best, and there were those that did better than others, and there were many people in the world at that time who thought that they were pretty darn great at following the rules. But when Jesus shows up, he sort of throws a wrench into it. The Israelites live, after they get these rules, another 1,000 to 1,500 years-ish before Jesus shows up. And then this next part of God's plan comes into play. Jesus is born, and he starts his ministry. And what he says in one of his early sermons, the Sermon on the Mount, really does throw a wrench into the lives of a lot of people who thought they were doing pretty great. Matthew 5, verses 21 and 22, and 27 and 28. You have heard that it was said to the people long ago, you shall not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to a brother or sister, Raca, is answerable to the court. Raca was just an insult at the time. Very similar to you fool. And anyone who says you fool will be in danger of the fire of hell. You have heard it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. So really, no one is good at keeping the law, because we can't even control our bodies, forget our brains. This wall just keeps getting higher and higher, and the gates still aren't opening. Until the day that we are going to celebrate in a month, the day that Jesus died on the cross. I know we celebrate Easter more, the day that Jesus rose from the dead, but it's the day that he died on the cross that actually means so much more to us as followers of Christ. Obviously, he didn't raise from the dead, that was proof that he was actually the Son of God. So still very important. But on Good Friday, when Jesus died, actually, I'll back up a second. There's one place in the world that God's presence could be before Jesus' death. And that was inside a place called the Holy of Holies, which was inside the temple. And inside the temple, this area was sealed off from the normal folk by a 30-foot wide, 60-foot high, 4-inch thick piece of fabric. And at the moment that Jesus died on the cross, that curtain was ripped from top to bottom, showing us that we finally had a way back into the presence of God. We finally had a way to get back to heaven. And that was through Jesus. The separation was over. We had spent thousands of years looking for a way to do it, and we finally had it. Many will argue that we have our own sets of rules that we need to follow to be good Christ followers, and that is true to an extent. Once we take Jesus into our lives, it's not that we immediately subscribe to a list of rules that we have to follow to be right with God. What we're actually doing when we accept Jesus into our life and when we choose to follow him is we are submitting ourselves to God and what he wants from us and for us. Once again, C.S. Lewis from Mere Christianity. The principle runs through all life from top to bottom. Give up yourself and you will find your real self. Lose your life and you will save it. Submit to death. Death of your ambitions and favorite wishes every day, and death of your whole body. In the end, submit with every fiber of your being, and you will find eternal life. Keep back nothing. Nothing that you have not given away will be really yours. Nothing in you that has not died will ever be raised from the dead. Look for yourself, and you will find in the long run only hatred, loneliness, despair, rage, ruin, and decay. But look for Christ, and you will find him. And with him, everything else thrown in. The New Testament is full of rules to various peoples, depending on the situations that they were in and the struggles that they were facing. And a lot of those do still apply to us. The Ten Commandments from the Old Testament included. But that's not the main point. What C.S. Lewis is describing here is what it truly means to be a Christian. When we choose to follow Jesus, we give up our lives to try and be like Christ. And we will certainly fail. We won't be perfect in this life. It's impossible. But we're meant to try. And perfection isn't the goal. This is where the focus on the choice that Jesus has given us really helps. When we focus on trying to do all of the right things, when we focus on just trying to check off the boxes, we become self-focused. And when we are self-focused, we find the things that C.S. Lewis mentions here, only hatred, loneliness, despair, rage, ruin, and decay. Yes, it's still good to keep ourselves in check. Yes, we're not supposed to just let it all loose and do whatever we want. But that's not our focus. Our focus is meant to be on others. And this is the beauty of the choice. When we have chosen to accept Jesus into our lives and to submit to him and to follow him, we have security in knowing where we are going to go. And so then we can focus on serving others. When we focus on being like Christ and serving others, we'll find so much more joy. Our struggles, our battles with sin in our lives actually become easier. Our battles with depression and mental illness actually become easier because we're focused on helping those around us. This has been scientifically proven outside of faith that the more people help others, the more that we give ourselves to others and put ourselves in the shoes of others, we actually find our own health improving. And we see this in the ministry of Jesus as well. Yes, Jesus was perfect, without a doubt. But that wasn't the cornerstone of his ministry. The cornerstone of his ministry was grace, humility, kindness, servitude. Everyone he met. And we are meant to do the same. Choose to follow Jesus. Don't focus on the law. Focus on showing love to the world. Choose to serve those around us. We don't see them if we're focused on ourselves. Choose the path that leads to heaven, because this life is not the end game. Philippians 1 verse 21 says, For to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. What Paul is saying in this statement is that he is looking forward to heaven. He's ready to be taken home, but as long as he's here, he will do the work of Jesus. If Jesus calls us to a life serving others, however that looks for each of us, is it worth the eternal gift?